service. Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where a packed audience are already applauding the young players of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra coming on stage here to play the second instalment of their cycle, complete cycle of Beethoven's nine symphonies. This orchestra, set up by their conductor Daniel Barenboim in 1999, formed from players, young musicians all over the Middle East. And tonight, after we heard the first and second symphony last night, we're going to hear the fourth symphony in just a couple of minutes, and the third, the epic Eroica, in the second half, with another masterpiece by French composer Pierre Boulez before the interval, his Dialogue de l'Ombre Double for live clarinet and taped Shadow of Itself. So, two down and seven to go. How's it all going for the players? Well, Mirav Katachevsky is an Israeli oboist who's been playing in the Divan since 2003. And she told me about the special relationship between the orchestra and Barenboim.
He claims to get a lot from us. I don't know how much he learns from us, or it's mainly the satisfaction of us wanting to learn from him. I think when he works with older orchestras, they are maybe a bit less open to new things than young people are. I think that gives him great satisfaction, at least he tells us so.
Mirav Katachevsky, who you can hear play second oboe in the performance of the Eroica Symphony that the West Eastern Divan Orchestra will give after the interval. It's the fourth symphony we're going to hear first, though. Now, after the enormity of the Eroica that Beethoven wrote as his third, you'll often hear that this symphony is a Haydn-esque throwback to an earlier, less ambitious kind of symphony. Balderdash. Yes, it's shorter than the third, but the fourth, first heard in 1807, is a piece that opens new expressive regions for Beethoven and the whole form. It starts in minor key gloom, which is really an upbeat to an energetic allegro first movement. Then comes the emotional heart of the symphony, the slow movement, the adagio, a scherzo, and then a wild finale. A wild applause now for Daniel Barenboim, who comes on stage to conduct his West Eastern Divan Orchestra, shaking the hands of his son Michael Barenboim, the leader, in this performance to conduct Beethoven's fourth symphony.
Thank you.
Beethoven's Fourth Symphony. Daniel Barenboim conducted the West Eastern Divan Orchestra here at the Royal Albert Hall. A real wildness in that final movement. One of the things you may have noticed at home is the way that Barenboim has set up this orchestra, just like he did last night. He has the first violins on his left, the second violins on his right. So you get that wonderful sense of conversation, communication, even conflict between the two sets of violins, between the right and left speaker, as you're listening at home. And a real sense of connection amongst the players too. Watching the first flute and first oboe tonight, they're just having such fun, this orchestra of young people, when they're playing together. It's all the little looks they're giving, even now the laughs they're exchanging and the conversations they're having about the performance they've just given, as Daniel Barenboim comes on stage again, accepting this rapturous applause and bringing the woodwind section to their feet, the principal clarinet. A young orchestra, this, the youngest member of all, sits in the first violins, a Palestinian violinist who's 15 years old, and he's already been playing with the West Eastern Divan Orchestra for 4 years. The vast majority of the players, though, in their late 20s and early 30s, and many of them have been with this orchestra for many years already. Barenboim wanted people who knew his approach to Beethoven, who understood the culture of the orchestra, to come here to the Proms to give this Beethoven cycle. He walks in front of the orchestra now and gives us, the audience, the chance to applaud all sides, every player in the West Eastern Divan Orchestra. There are players from the Middle East. There are also Spanish musicians in this orchestra. That's because the workshops every year, before they go on a world tour every year, happen in Seville, a tribute to that period of European history when Islam, Judaism and Christianity existed peacefully in the early Middle Ages. Well, the Eroica Symphony, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, that seismic step in symphonic composition coming up after the interval. But now it's time for another piece by French composer Pierre Boulez, whose music Barenboim is partnering with Beethoven throughout the cycle of the symphonies, which climaxes, of course, with the 9th on Friday night, a day that also happens to be the opening of a certain wee sporting event somewhere else in London. We're going to hear, in fact, Boulez's Dialogue de l'Ombre Double, Dialogue of the Double Shadow, a piece for clarinetist, tonight played by Youssef Issa, and a taped version of himself, sounds that will be spun and flung around the space of the Royal Albert Hall and your radios at home. The piece was composed for Italian composer Luciano Berio's 60th birthday in the mid-1980s, in 1985, and it owes this mix of technology and a live instrument to the wizardry of the musicians and scientists working at IRCAM, the Centre for Research into Computer and Acoustic Music that Boulez set up in 1976. Now, Dialogue lasts for about 20 minutes, and although the piece plays continuously, there's a continual to-ing and fro-ing between the tape clarinet sounds and the noises, the sounds that the live player is making. It all starts with the tape, though, and in darkness, too. So this whole sweep of Dialogue de l'Ombre Double is a challenge for tonight's soloist, Youssef Issa, who learned the piece, he told me, partly by playing it to the composer.
I had a lesson with him, played for him, and it was really interesting. He's very friendly, but when he works, it's very clear and very calm, and everything's, yeah. I mean, I didn't play so well, but because I had problems with my hands, but it's better now.
Just be completely clear on the structure of the piece then.
Yes.
You play on stage from six different music stands,
exactly.
Six strophes. Around either side of them is a part for a tape clarinet, which will be projected around the Royal Albert Hall. Now, is that the sound of you playing as well?
Exactly, yeah. I recorded it in Paris at the IRCAM. First, the recording starts and the stage is dark. And then when I start playing, the lights on stage is being raised. Through the piece, you have different motives and different characters. And these are related to each other. There are some parts that they're very fast, sometimes pianissimo. And then suddenly they grow and they get piano again. And it's kind of a prayer in a way. So it feels very spiritual, the music. And then you have these trills that are very calm and long phrases with very abrupt interruption. These are the main motives in a way that repeat itself throughout the piece.
At the end of the piece, the final part is yes. For the tape, but you play a very high D along with it. Do you feel there's a kind of resolution at the end between all of the elements of the piece, or is it another question mark that the piece is leaving us with, leaving you with?
In a way, it's a fade out. That's at least how I feel, that you have the feeling that it continues in a way. It's not really an end. It might be to continue it in a way.
And the shadow, the piece ends in a kind of gloom, a darkness again, yes. With which it started.
Yeah, exactly.
How hard is this piece for you to play?
I mean, it's hard for the concentration and also for the body. I mean, you need to be very relaxed. And, you know, when you play in Royal Albert Hall, of course, it's not very relaxing. But, yeah, I hope I'll manage it. Let's see. I hope I'll have fun on stage.
Youssef Issa, who's just come on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, setting up his music across the six music stands arranged in a semicircle at the front of the stage. There's going to be different lighting effects. This is a real sort of a kind of subtle kind of music theatre that the Royal Albert Hall is going to be exposed to. And the way the sounds are going to be flung around the hall, it's going to create a real sense of, well, Youssef Issa said it himself, this spiritual, even devotional quality to this music. We feel like we're going on a journey inside the sounds the clarinet makes. Now, the sounds of Dialogue de l'Ombre Double are always changing and always transforming. And there's even another element, which Youssef didn't have the chance to explain there, which is backstage at the Albert Hall, there's a room, actually a rather fancy room. Anyway, in it is a grand piano. And the sounds that Yusuf Isaac makes live on stage are going to be filtered through. They're going to be played into the strings of that grand piano and then projected out into the space of the Royal Albert Hall and to your speakers at home. So there's another level of transformational complexity going on. A tribute to the two IRCAM engineers who are here too, who are going to be making all this happen, Gilbert Nuno and Jeremy Henrault. Boulez himself, though, is at pains to point out that his experience of IRCAM was not about creating some sort of sequestered hermetic laboratory where scientists would beaver away and create a kind of mechanical music. Not at all. What he was always trying to do, and the reason that IRCAM existed, was to make that connection between electronics, what you can do with electronics, and live experience, to amplify the effect of what Yusuf Isaac can do with his clarinet. Now, he comes on stage here to take a bow and accept this applause before the beginning that will happen in darkness and with the taped sound of Pierre Boulez's Dialogue de l'Ombre Double.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Pierre Boulez's Dialogue de l'Ombre Double, Dialogue of the Double Shadow. Youssef Issa is the clarinet soloist, playing with Tate's recordings and electronic versions of himself being spun around the Royal Albert Hall. Comes back on stage to accept the whoops and cheers for him and for Pierre Boulez's music. You know, I'm not sure the Victorian architects and builders of this huge cavernous rotunda in South Kensington realised that they were creating a truly great venue for electronic music, but that's exactly what they inadvertently did. That piece, made by Pierre Boulez and in collaboration with IRCAM, the two sound engineers who also were a key part of that performance were Gilbert Nuno and Jeremy Henro. Well, it's interval time in tonight's prom, and in the first of two features, Paul Farley explores the 19th century German poems that gave their name to the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in Goethe and the West Eastern Divan.
In a park in the center of Weimar, Germany, there's a contemporary bronze and stone sculpture. Two granite chairs face each other across a stone base, decorated with Arabic script. This sculpture commemorates the West Eastern Divan, a remarkable poetic cycle begun in 1815 by the German poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe and inspired by the work of the 14th century Persian poet Hafiz. Annette Zeman is a Weimar-based writer.
We are on the Beethovenplatz, where we see here a monument. It is called Hafiz Monument. It was a symbol for tolerance towards other cultures. And on the floor we have a sort of carpet in stone with bronze ornaments. That's like a Persian carpet. And we are at both sides. We have a poetry written in German from the Divan. Wer sich selbst und andere kennt, wird auch hier erkennen, Orient und Occident sind nicht mehr zu trennen. Those who know themselves and others will realize here too that the Orient and the Occident have become inseparable.
Today, the West Eastern Divan has become a name we associate with cooperation and collaboration across cultural and political divides. It was in Weimar, at a music school held in the summer of 1999, that Daniel Barenboim and Edward Said created a new orchestra, composed of musicians from Israel, Palestine, and other Arab countries. And their choice of name for the orchestra was inspired by Goethe's cycle of poems. Say, divan, and we're likely to think of furniture, but in Arabic, divan means a collection or assembly. And in his divan, Goethe, the German polymath of the early 19th century, channels Hafiz, the medieval Persian poet.
As we ride the steep and rocky paths, great Hafiz, yours the lucky songs our leader sings, rejoicing on his high-backed mule, enticing all the stars from sleep and scaring robbers from our rich wayfaring. In the baths and taverns too, Hafiz, I remember you. When some sweetheart lifts her veil, shakes her scented locks, the tale of our whispered love shall fashion even the houri's hearts to passion. Who shall envy me such pleasure? Who would shorten its full measure? Let him note, in words upsoaring, softly knocking and imploring, poets ever haunt heaven's portal, seeking, finding life immortal.
At the time of writing the Divan, Goethe was living in the small city of Weimar, but he had always been open to external influences. He read widely and voraciously, consuming a book a day from the Anna Amalia Library. Goethe's middle years were heavily influenced by his travels in Italy and are now regarded as his classical period. But he had always been interested in Middle Eastern culture, and this fascination was fueled by some of the friends who visited him.
Now we are in the entrance of Goethe's house, and the entrance was the part he changed mostly when he got the house. And his model was the Italian palaces. And when we ascend now the staircase, it is becoming really solemn. There are statues, paintings from the antiquity, and visitors who came from all over Europe were really intimidated by that entrance. And on the doorstep it is written Salve, that means be welcome. But some persons did not know exactly if they were welcome or not. Music room. Here, the young Franz Liszt played the piano for Goethe and also Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy at the age of 10 years, methinks. So it is also a museum of European guests visiting Goethe. One of his friends and visitors was his friend Herda, who was really very much inspired by the Quran and gave that inspiration to Goethe. But Goethe, we can say, at that special moment in the 1815s until 1820, is the one who had the widest horizon for the Oriental culture.
Goethe had already written a poem at the age of 23 in praise of the Prophet Muhammad, and he shared Herder's respect for Muhammad as both poet and prophet. Under Herder's influence, he became even more fascinated by the Quran and by the elevated style of Islamic scripture. Like a true scholar, he studied a number of translations of the Quran, and he was also happy to hint that he might even be a Muslim himself, writing, "He, the poet, does nothing which would rebut any suspicion that he himself could be a Muslim." In 1813, Goethe received a page of the Quran in both Persian and Arabic, which had been brought back from Spain by a soldier fighting in the Napoleonic Wars. At around the same time, Goethe also came into possession of several other Middle Eastern manuscripts, and he attended an Islamic prayer service in Weimar held by Muslim soldiers recently arrived from Russia. He was deeply moved by the event, and it left a lasting impression. Marina Warner is a cultural historian, critic and novelist. Marina, there are other things that seem to be nudging him in the direction of this poem. It's almost like this kind of superstition. He feels like he's been led to it.
Completely. Goethe, you know, he's a polymath, and he, like quite a lot of people who are interested in thousands of things, his curiosity had led him to sort of hermetic systems. And he actually was, by our standards, truly deeply superstitious, and he believed these were omens. One of the verses of the Quran that he was written on the fragment was the end of the Quran, which is one of its most famous blessings, which says, this text, this verse, this will help you against the slinking whisperer, the slinking whisperer being the devil. And he took the fact that this had come his way, this fragment, as a message. Mm-hmm. And he already had very powerful, turbulent feelings about Christianity. He'd had numerous run-ins with the authorities for his free thinking and his experimental research. And this seemed to confirm it. Here he had a message that he must avoid the people who were turning him away from the greater knowledge, the deeper understanding that he might have. And after that, he truly becomes, to our present eyes and ears now, a surprising advocate of Islam.
I find it foolish and quite odd that stubborn folk seek to deny if Islam means we all serve God. We all in Islam live and die.
Marina, in your recent book, Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights, you explore Goethe's engagement with Persian poetry. What fascinates me is let's paint a picture here. Goethe's in his mid-60s, and he starts this huge project, the West Eastern Divan. What led him to this? Was there a trigger moment or a tipping point?
Well, Goethe himself was taken by surprise by this terrific late flowering of his lyric self and wonderful energy in the poems. He had been interested in exotic or oriental languages for a long time. He began with Hebrew. He began by studying the original language of the Bible. And he was obviously very gifted at languages. And he moved gradually through several, and he even became good enough to write a little bit in Arabic. But what sparked this were the translations into German for the first time of the Persian poet Hafiz. And it was a love affair. And interestingly, the scholar Matthew Reynolds has just written an interesting book called The Poetics of Translation. And in that he says that this is one of the ways that people engage with a text in a foreign language. It's desire, it's love, it's identification. It's a form of sort of re-impersonation. You pour yourself into this other voice and you then become another self. And Goethe talks about that in the poems that he wrote in response to Hafiz. He saw Hafiz as a twin soul and as a liberating kind of energy that he had encountered in his dotage, if you like.
That you can make no ending makes you great. That you have no beginning is your fate. Your song turns round, a star vault heaven frame, beginning, ending, evermore the same. And the clear import of the middle part is present at the end as at the start. Of joys, you are the truest poet spring, that wave on wave unnumbered up will fling, lips ever ready for a kiss, from ardent breast a hymn that flows, throat eager for the drinker bliss, a kind outpouring heart that glows. Should the whole world to ruin sink, Hafiz, with you alone I'd vie. Desire and painful moan, we'll share them both. We twins have grown to be like you in love, in drink. My pride, my life in this be shown. My song, your fire's unique to you. You have united old and new.
Hafiz lived in interesting times, when Persia was invaded by the Mongol conqueror Timur, otherwise known as Tamerlane, whom Hafiz met. Goethe was no stranger to invasion and occupation himself, living through the Napoleonic Wars and, like Hafiz, meeting the great warrior of the age, Napoleon, in person. Goethe was deeply attracted to Hafiz. He seemed to enjoy the contradictions of a poet who was both religious but also unorthodox, a virtuoso poet and committed hedonist. To say he liked a drink would be the understatement of the 14th century. He was a lover and a fighter, a mystic and an awkward customer, earthy and ethereal.
Hafiz, mit dir allein will ich wetteifern, Lust und Pein, sei uns, den Zwillingen, gemein. So you can see the twin brothers is the German Zwillingen. Twin brothers we. I think using this very close term was for Goethe a way to show how important Hafiz was for him.
Rita Seifert is a writer and archivist who lives in Weimar. She's the author of a book on Goethe and Napoleon.
Goethe was very impressed by the consciousness of tradition the Arabic writers showed. And he prized their feeling for the language, for their own language, and their spirit and their wisdom. And on the other side, Goethe also liked the contradictions of the Arabic way of life. On one side, you have the strict religionists, and on the other side, you have the free thinking. But I think a very important thing is also to say that Goethe's demon is a kind of salutation to the East. I give you my hand, and I would like that we and our cultures come together. And at this time, I think this is a very important point. Maybe it is the main message we can say of this.
The main opening poem of the West Eastern Divan is called Hegira.
North and west and south are breaking, thrones are shattered, empires shaking. Flee to the pure east and there taste its patriarchal air. Love, wine, song are waiting for you. Kaiser's fountain shall restore you.
Silke Scheuermann and Matthias Goeritz are German poets and writers based in Frankfurt, the city where Goethe was born.
Hegira, the opening poem of the collection, Hegira refers to the Arab word of Higra, which means migration, basically. So it's that kind of migration, this kind of like wandering around towards a different country, towards a different language and tradition, poetical tradition, which really captures the sense of what Goethe wants to do here. He wants to
also escape. Escape was a very positive connotation for him. His most beloved philosopher, Spinoza, said fight or escape is both good things. And so it's like, let's escape to the east.
Yeah, that's a very positive concept. But it's not only on the run. I mean, Goethe has this famous tradition of, even when he couldn't cope with the court at Weimar, he went to Italy, his famous Italy travels. And actually, this West Eastern Divan kind of mirrors the experience which Goethe had in Rome and in Italy. It was in Italy. It was, and everybody in Germany knows this. Everybody who's a Goethe fan, that was a kind of a rebirth. You know, the meeting with antiquity, Renaissance. You know, also his love affairs there with Faustina in Rome and all the other girls, and the wine drinking, blah blah blah. But it happens again. And when he was 65, so he was constantly reinventing himself. Yeah, he was rebirthed all the time by love and by poetry.
Yeah.
In that right world, in that pure world, I'll dig deep into the sure world, origins of humankind, and that simple law I'll find, which they learnt, unschooled, God-given, dropped in earthly tongues from heaven. Theirs were fathers high respected, alien thraldom they rejected. Hail, glad, early youth of man, faith wide flung, thought's narrow span. In their worlds a power unbroken dwelt, for all their words were spoken. Herdsman's company I'll keep, in oases fresh and deep, travel with the caravans, trade in musk through burning sands. All the coffee trails I'll wander, deserts here to cities yonder.
Marina, do you think we take the 13 books as a whole, the Divan, and do you think it contains anything like a unifying message? What do you think his intentions were overall, if you stand right back from it?
Well, I think that both Goethe's intentions and the actual effect of the book are extremely important now. And that is the reason that the West East Divan Orchestra was called after the book. Goethe had an intimation, and Edward Said knew that. He knew the book. He had an intimation that there was more cross-correspondence, engagement and potential in the dialogue and indeed the fusion of West and East than had ever been acknowledged.
To God belongs the Orient, to God belongs the Occident, the northern and the southern lands resting tranquil in his hands.
He also, as a poet and a philosopher, saw that culture works at a different speed and to a different kind of motion and energy than do military and political maneuvers. And that actually, if you try to look at the cultural history of two great powers meeting, as it were, the Ottoman Empire and the West, look at it culturally, you can see something different. And it's tremendously significant that Edward Said did choose this name, and it was never contradicted or discussed. It was always the name of the orchestra. People always accepted it. It was seen to be, as it were, prophetic and powerful name. And when he had written the famous book, 1978, Orientalism, in which he denounced Orientalism, you'd think that Goethe's book would seem Orientalist, but not to Said, because he didn't see it as part of a political program of conquest. He saw that Goethe was opening himself up. It was exploratory in a way that allowed the thought that he encountered to enter him, rather than the acquisition and the colonial attitudes of, say, the Napoleonic expedition to Egypt, which is where Edward Said's book denouncing Orientalism begins. Mm. So this was not, as it were, appropriative, but it was simply inspirational and would lead, I mean, many, many commentators on both Goethe and on Persian and Arabic poetry have pointed to this moment as a moment when many intricate metric forms begin to be adopted and adapted by European writers. Mm.
By travelling through time and transforming himself into Hafiz, Goethe was able to enter into a truly global conversation that was quite other to classical Western literature. Through this visionary tribute to Hafiz, Goethe moved European poetry into a dialogue with the Oriental tradition, a tradition rooted in the lyric mode. His West Eastern Divan plugged poetry back into its musical roots and reintroduced words to the physical pulse of song.
And during the interval of Monday evening's prom at about 8:30 between Beethoven's Pastoral and Fifth Symphonies, Paul Farley explores the real-life love story at the heart of Goethe's West Eastern Divan. The translations you heard there were by Martin Bidney and David Luke. The readers were Robert Blythe and Susie Riddell, and the producer was Emma Harding. You're listening to BBC Radio 3, the home of the BBC proms. I'm Tom Service. Now, a quick reminder of all the treasures you can find at the website bbc.co.uk/proms. Concert programmes for each prom are available half an hour before each prom starts. You can listen again to every prom for a week that it's available on the iPlayer. There's the archive where you can search every concert that's happened as part of the BBC prom since they began in 1895. And you can download a daily 3-minute proms music guide. All that and more. Applause as the musicians of the West Eastern Divan Orchestra come on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's prom and Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, the next station in Daniel Barenboim's Beethoven cycle with this West Eastern Divan Orchestra. It's a symphony that the orchestra has played many times together, and for tonight's second oboist, Miraf Kadyshevsky, it's a symphony with really special resonance.
This brings back a lot of memories, and at the same time, I can feel how the orchestra has advanced during these years. We've been working with Barenboim, and we've been getting so much from him, and it has changed completely our way of playing and thinking about music, and we've grown mature with his teachings. So, of course, there's a big difference since 2003 and today.
Is every performance you give of the Eroica Symphony, and you must have given the piece, what, a dozen times with the orchestra or something?
Well, I haven't counted, few, actually. Right? Yeah, quite a few.
Are they different every time? Is it always a special occasion? Does something special always happen in performance?
Every concert is different. As a human being, you know, every day we are a bit different. You know, it depends what we've gone through during the day. It depends if we've had coffee or not. You know, our heart beats a bit faster or slower, so we feel the tempo a little bit differently. The whole concept of music is something very personal. And since that tends to change a lot, then the music goes through us changing all the time. I mean, music in itself is change. It's never static.
But this piece is going to end the same way it always does, in a blaze of glory, isn't it? It's going to, you
know. Yeah.
Miraf Kadyshevsky, tonight's second oboist in this performance of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony that we're about to hear. Now, the facts of this symphony are startling enough. It was first performed on the 7th of April, 1805, and even after the grand ambition of Beethoven's second symphony that we heard last night, the Eroica amplifies the scale and emotional reach, the cultural and even political ambition of the symphony as a form, as an idea. And Beethoven takes all that to places that no composer had previously dared to imagine. The story of the Eroica's dedication to Napoleon in 1803, and then Beethoven's subsequent erasing of that dedication to Napoleon Bonaparte when he learned that Napoleon had crowned himself emperor, is well known. But the point is, the Eroica, the Heroic, as it was eventually published in 1806, is a moment when the boundaries between instrumental music and cultural meaning start to blur. You see, in no sense is the Eroica Symphony simply a symphonic entertainment. The first movement on its own is as long as most entire 18th century symphonies. The second is a funeral march. The third, a scherzo of new rustic power. Listen out especially for the way that Beethoven uses the symphony's three horns, an innovation that no symphony had ever been written with three horns before. And the finale is a Protean set of variations. But here's the thing. Beethoven's musical material, on its own terms, its notes, the stuff of its notes, demands this new gigantic symphonic scale. And yet, at the same time, it seems to demand an extra musical interpretation as well. Who is the funeral march for? The hero? The old ways of monarchy, a symphonic convention? Or is it a future funeral rite for Napoleon? And that finale that contains, it seems, the whole world in its range of speeds and characters, is it really a simple single resolution or a celebration of human and musical difference and diversity? Well, it's all that and more, of course, as we're about to discover right now, as Daniel Barenboim comes on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall to conduct the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E-flat major, the Eroica.
Thank you.
the end of Beethoven's Eroica Symphony here at the Royal Albert Hall. Daniel Barenboim, still looking at his orchestra, conducted the West Eastern Divan Orchestra in that performance. He's sort of mopping his brow and congratulating, seems to be congratulating the members of his orchestra, shaking hands there with the front desks of the string section. And finally, at last, turning to accept this huge applause for the Royal Albert Hall audience. You know, the composer Carl Czerny remembers that first performance of the Eroica. Barenboim again acknowledging the Albert Hall audience. Czerny remembers that first performance in 1805, the 7th of April at the Theater an der Wien in Vienna. And he remembers somebody shouting in the audience, "I'll give a kreutzer if the thing will only stop." Well, the message tonight is that this audience would give many kreutzers, many pounds of these, for that performance to be repeated. Something, of course, you can do at home on the iPlayer for the next 7 days. The oboist, Mirav Kadachevsky, we were talking to in the orchestra before that performance, said that each performance is special of that piece, each one different. So many things were vital, energized, and new about that performance. So many things to enjoy, and indeed to enjoy again. Now, though, with that applause still ringing in our ears and our brains and bodies here, time to hand you back to Broadcasting House, hand you on to Jonathan Swain for the rest of the evening here on BBC Radio 3. Jonathan.
Tom, thank you very much. Tom Service there at the Royal Albert Hall. And just to add, there's a much earlier than usual start time for Berlioz's Trojans, the prom, tomorrow night, live from the Albert Hall. We'll be back live at the hall for Act One of the Trojans at 4:30 tomorrow afternoon. As for tonight's prom, as Tom was saying, you can, of course, listen to it again anytime you like for the next 7 days via the BBC Radio Player. And there's another chance to hear a broadcast of the concert here on BBC Radio 3 this coming Thursday afternoon at 2:00. Barenboim's approach wouldn't have been out of place 40 years ago, wrote the critic for The Independent about last night's first concert in the orchestra's Beethoven cycle at the Proms. And the review went on, having coached its core of players for so long, Barenboim now has at his fingertips his own personal ensemble, which he can play like a piano, so attuned are its members to his musicianship. Jessica Duchin in today's Independent. Well, Chinese life evoked in words and on the bamboo flute is our next programme tonight. That's at 10:00. For the moment, though, Daniel Barenboim, the pianist, in J.S. Bach, the Prelude and Fugue number 16 in G minor from the second book of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier.
Thank you.
The Prelude and Fugue, number 16 in G minor, from the second book of Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier, and it was played there by Daniel Barenboim. It's just gone 10 o'clock, and now Between the Ears, Radio 3's series of innovative features, presents a second chance to hear a memoir in music, sound and words. The musician, composer and cook Guo Yue, who grew up during China's Cultural Revolution, tells his story in On the Rubble of My Home, I Played My Flute.
I was born in this beautiful city called Beijing. My part of Hutong, which is the little alleys, which is like a maze. The big brick wall, gray color, beside you. And you look up, you can only see the sky. When I was little, I remember life of Hutong is full of different sound. Very, very, very early morning, you hear all the people. The singing voice come out is amazing, and they carry it long way because there's a lot of echo, you know, along the alley. It carries all the way. And you hear people shouting like, My Xiao Zhi Lou, or Shu Wei Bin. It's like almost like Peking opera sound, you know, like really like opera sound. And actually, they are selling little chicks and little goldfish, and some people collecting metals, some people collecting cottons. All different shouting sound, but very friendly sound, and you want to get up. So actually, they start 4:30. So once you hear that, you can never sleep again because you feel very excited. Especially, I love the moment when the vegetable people shout, 今天西红柿来了，茄子来了，土豆. So it's tomato, aubergine, today arrived. So can you imagine, in our mind, we already had a dish like tomato and aubergine, red and purple, with ginger, with garlic. You already 4:30, 5 o'clock, start. You have the food, fragrance, in your mind, the perfume come out. So everybody get up and queue up, and the day start. It's beautiful life. I lived in a compound, all five musician family, because my father is a musician, and he plays Chinese violin, which is called er hu, two strings, and has this beautiful sound. I don't remember so much about my father. But I do remember is he plays under the moon, in the courtyard, look at the moon, and play this kind of music. And I used to think it's quite sad, like a dark cloud covered the moon, that feeling. And now I understand, because my father was very ill. I lost my father when I was 5 years old. He worked in this company called Chinese Central Dance and Singing Ensemble. His instrument case, you know, that instrument lay on this beautiful reddish, dark red velvet. I used to think, just for that reason, I want to become a musician. I want to carry an instrument because just open it, it's so beautiful. So from little, every day I hear it's a lot of singing and instrumental playing, shouting between wife and husband because some of them play too loud and the wife wants to do something else. And the most beautiful things musicians like to do is play music and cook. So in the evenings, 5 or 6 o'clock, you hear every place start. or... You hear some people chopping. Tired after a whole day. And you hear some people. Oh, quite in a thoughtful mood. Thinking about children going to school, work. And some people. Completely mad, crazy, love the vegetable so much. Want to dance with the vegetable. So from the chopping, you hear people, what do they eat? What they are going to cook tonight? And for example, some people chop like meat. Because you can't do this to meat. That is nobody. Yeah, so you have to go. Some people chop like... That's breaking bones, because Chinese people love eat meat. Has to be with bones to break it. So you can see, oh, they're eating meat today. I used to be very jealous because my family can't afford very much meat. So we can only... And my sister used to chopping and singing. And then she goes to the wall, toss the wall, and then have a dance. When the potato is cooking. I love this so much. But that image is always in my mind, and I miss that very much, actually. Every day I hear music, so I really wanted to learn an instrument. So I asked my mother if I could have a little bamboo flute. My mother said we couldn't afford. I think it cost less than a penny in my days. But still we didn't have that one penny. So I said to my mother, if you don't buy me the flute, I will lie down outside in the courtyard, not get out. So cold, snow. And I really did lie down for 2 or 3 hours. I remember my mother cried. So she said, you can't have a little bamboo flute. My demonstration successful. So ask my neighbor who is wind the instrument, who is my early teacher, who took me to this beautiful shop. And I remember, I love the smells of the bamboo. It's so beautiful, it's a red color. He taught me how to start the note. It's so beautiful when you start a single note. I remember that moment, and then I just fell in love with the little bamboo flute. During this difficult period of China, I felt that little bamboo flute made my world so big. I have to practice long note 1.5 hours to 2 hours a day. Sometimes I go... I stand up, fell asleep, but because that, I think made me can play nice music. And then when he taught me, I said, I love that because it makes me exciting, you know? So this is amazing sound can lead you to freedom. All I can remember, the start of the Cultural Revolution, is this big, loud speaker sound. Shouting too much, you don't understand, but you know there's something horrible happening. It's like that. But actually they are shouting about, you know, Mao. The loudspeaker sound, with big banging on a lot of drums, and this loud cymbals. I think it's quite horrible sound sometimes. Go dang, 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 dang. Peking opera use it. But actually, when I was little, I didn't like that sound very much. And even today, I don't think it does very good to my ears. So they have horrible sound and a lot of singing. Everybody get together. Young people, especially the Red Guard, and have a lot of songs. All I learned during this period is revolutionary songs, music, and the words. It's all about communism, revolution. This is a song we sing every morning, every evening, every lunchtime, all the time. Everybody. 红方红太阳升中国出了个毛泽东他为人民冒幸福呼儿嘿哟他是人民大救星共产党像太阳照到哪里哪里 Actually, this song is a farmer's after work from the field, you know. 今天我工作了 He sang, the farmer singing, today I finished work. My wife cooked me red stewed pork with star anise, ginger, spring onion. Mao turned to red sun from the east. China come out of Mao Zedong. So he make himself like a sun. In Yunnan province, in Hunan province, like 1,000 miles, so far away, they sing the same note at the same time. And then the whole China sing one note, one song. So of course, I find this is quite nice. There's a lot of music used during the Cultural Revolution. It's all sound. There's a lot of sound around. When I was little, I find it very exciting. But of course, not very excited to see people beaten and until death in front of us. I saw people hanging. It's very difficult to understand. Never heard the word suicide. Because we were only a few years old, 8 years old, 7 years old. So hung himself, and the landlord was beaten by the Red Guard in the courtyard. The Red Guard hand us sticks and bell, say, beat him. Do it! We want to run because we just get frightened. We feel very sorry for the people who are marched by the Red Guard on the tracks. There used to be about 20 of them, have to shave all their head. And in the board, they say, counter-revolutionary, landlord, factory owner, teacher. My mother was a language teacher. She taught English, Russian, and Japanese. For this reason, because she spoke foreign languages, and also, my mother, she wanted to be a modern woman, because in those days, a lot of women still had bounded feet. My mother is the first generation not have bounded feet and can go to university. My mother should have gone to Yan'an, joined Mao, and then my mother would become a big leader and a very important woman. But my mother, she went to Kuomintang school in Sichuan and taught English there and met my father in the school. He was teaching music. So the student one day took her away from us. We were in the courtyard. They say, Zhao Sulin, come on. So they say, you are bad because you are petty bourgeois. 小资产阶级. My mom say, why? Because you love beautiful makeup, you love clothes, you love Russian. We have to get rid of it. We have to get rid of you and all the people like you. The headmaster was accused being intellectual. He was tortured very badly. I remember my mother had to hear his screaming and everything, being beaten. And after a few days, he died. He was tortured until death. And then they called all the teachers, and my mother and her colleague have to carry the dead body marching the school ground just along to show everyone, if you are bad, this is what you get. They took my mother, come with us! And they tortured her. She always say, they are my children. Even the people beating her. And she still say, they are just like my children. I forgive them. And they tortured her, saying, why you speak English? You must be a traitor. You must be spy for England. She was tortured and sent to countryside for 3.5 years to be re-educated. My brother and me, when we were 8, my brother was 12, we look after ourselves. My brother plays this instrument made from many, many bamboo called sheng, which is like a mouth organ. So we both just have something to make us feel secure. I miss my mother at that time. And when I miss a lot of her, I think I play more flute. I use the sound to remember her and very kind of a show off to my mother for what your little son can do with a little bamboo flute. So I practice. When my sister Liang sent to the countryside on the journey in the truck, she met this young man. He is a very good singer. He loves singing Western opera so much. He adore all the operas. So he can't stop. Just open his voice and come out with this beautiful opera, such as it's beautiful. And the other one is go. And Chinese adore, they love Italian opera, Puccini. I think a lot of Puccini. So he sung a lot of opera in the field. He can't stop singing Western opera. I think he imagined Western country, Western world. All his life, he wasn't at all worried about getting in trouble. I think in the field, there's really no red guard watching the children. They are 15, 16 years old, so they feel like a little bird. They feel free for that little moment. They really have the freedom. If he hadn't been there, my sister wouldn't, you know, started singing. And because he's singing every day, and my sister just can't stop listen because it's so beautiful, the notes and the melody. My sister can't stop to learn from him and sing with him in the field. Because all of this, she auditioned for the army opera house, and because of him, she really successfully got the voice, got the whole thing. It is from the field, from this young man. Meanwhile, I was still in Beijing with my brother in the courtyard, and there's not much happening in the courtyard because most people sent to the countryside. I remember every day we have one little mirror that I have to put a stool in front and stand on the stool to practice in front of the mirror, because I've been told in front of the mirror see your embouchure, you know, your position of your bamboo flute with your mouth. So every day I practice 2 or 3 hours bamboo flute and just play music. Sometimes I go out to catch some cricket, dragonflies, and just because we didn't allow to have pets, pets was forbidden. So I can only bond with some wild animals. After 3 years, my mother returned to the alley, very weakened. So before she was quite a fast woman. She do things very fast. Now she's slower. I think it's because she worked so hard. During these 3 years, she had to dig the mud from the river. It's very heavy, very hard labor. And one day, she was informed by her student came to the college and said, Zhou Sulin, you can go back to teaching. My mother cried. Tomorrow, you get yourself ready. You come to school, your first lesson. I remember my mother was so excited, like can't sleep. And next day, I remember very clearly, is Nixon, the first American president, visits China. My mother got up very early, just comb her hair, got ready. And then she suddenly said, Xiao Yue, Little Yue, Little Leap Forward. My name in English, Little Leap Forward. Xiao Yue, go to find the people. And she already said, go to find, already can't talk. Paralyzed, stroke. Immediately half face, half body can't move. So all she waited to go to school and she couldn't teach anymore. So it's very sad. My generation all have to go to countryside, but me was very lucky because I had my flute. I play music, but I didn't use that just for escape. I really wanted to perform. So I auditioned for a Beijing Army orchestra to perform all over China for the troops in the deep mountains. They need beautiful music to make them feel how beautiful China is and to fight for China. That was my job, to make them cry, to make them love their country. When I joined the army, they gave me 2 boxes, which I love them so much. One is a little box, contains a little silver flute, Western silver flute. The other box is bigger and wooden with 18 bamboo flutes, 18 of them. Imagine I used to have one little bamboo flute cost less than a penny. Now I have 18 bamboo flutes. I think I'm like a king and an emperor. It's so beautiful. They are like, here is your weapon, guard your country. Exactly. So my guarding is play the music and my weapon is the instrument. So I always loved silver flute because it has different tone, different feeling. When I take the bamboo flute play, immediately I imagine myself on the mountains with Tai Chi, all the people, or revolution marching on the street. When I take a silver flute, I always think I am in this bow tie with dinner suit, like in the concert hall. The one tune I play a lot for the soldiers is called Swallow. It's this tune from Xinjiang province. Xinjiang is like quite far from Beijing. There, the people from Xinjiang province have big nose. For us, they are like foreigner. We always want to hear foreigner music. So the only tune we can play is inside China, but nearly the border with other country. So we feel that is from Western country. Thank you. In 1982, I obtained a passport because China started to allow people to apply to study in the West. And I got a place at Guildhall School of Music to study Western silver flute. I remember when I got my passport, there was many hundred people around me and never seen a passport in their life. And then my leader said, Guiyue, come here in the office. When you go to the West, you play beautiful music, you learn how to play good concert flute. Another thing you must do is regularly write us a letter to tell us how many homeless people are there under the bridge. Now, after that, I came out, I really saw some homeless people under South Bank Bridge. So I thought, do I write letters to them? No, never wrote letters to them. Until now, 30 years, I never wrote one letter. My mother always loved English and taught me English. So for that reason, I also decided to come to England. I want to know more music, more culture. But it is very hard to leave. I remember first I came to England. I even can't sleep in one room on my own because I was frightened. I never slept alone in my whole life. I always surrounded with four sisters, one brother in the same room. But I loved every moment of seeing different culture, different place and different people and different sound. I find I quite liked some of the pop music because it's so new for me. People like Wham, you know, like they went to China. Dear mommy, dear daddy, George Michael is like God because singing, like, how can you sing like that? We don't know, because so far it's all revolution in our songs. We never heard anything like that. So it's very, very interesting for me. When I was in China, I wasn't allowed to play my own music. I only can play the music they asked me to play. It's like you are in a well before you see a sky. Only that big, like a little round circle. Music is like that. When I come out, I didn't know the sky is so big. And the music, you can play so many different notes and mood and melodies and using so many different instruments. In China, I always say, one day I'll write a tune called Mother and Son, which I did. Now here I performed with all different orchestras about, you know, my feeling of my mother, how I see her suffer and how I see her so happy but so sad during the revolution. So I want to use music to describe all this experience. But when I was in China, I wasn't able to do that. But now I have a chance. I can play music from my own heart. Now, I go back to China regularly, to Beijing. Before last time, every time I go back to the same alley to see the same courtyard and other people still living there, the life is still exactly the same when I was 7-6 years old. It's incredible. But now, when I go back last time, there were workers there. There was so much dust because they have this machine pulling them down, pulling all the whole street down. I really say, stop. I said, excuse me, what are you doing? Stop. And he said, we are making this a tube station. I said, what? Wait. Can you stop working for a few minutes? Let me play a little bit of bamboo flute because this is my home. I was very sad. I took my flute out on the whole pile of bricks of this little home is gone. And I played. Thank you.
On the rubble of my home I played my flute, a memoir in music, sound and words by Guo Yue. It was produced by Julian May with Juliet Rix. The programme was first broadcast in June last year. And just to add, there are some photographs of Guo Yue playing his bamboo flute and with his family in China on the Between the Ears page of the Radio 3 website.
The 2012 BBC Proms. Les Troyens at the BBC Proms. An astonishing score, the summation of a life's work in music and a work the composer himself never heard complete. The cast of the Royal Opera's new production reunites under the music director Sir Antonio Pappano in a concert performance of Berlioz's epic opera. Berlioz's tri-story, Les Troyens, the Trojans, at the BBC Proms. Tomorrow afternoon and evening from 4:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And now on Radio 3, this week's helping of new music introduced by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to Here and Now, and a programme packed with premieres, six in total. Three of them come from the 20 by 12 PRS for Music Foundation commissions. We'll hear Oliver Searle, who was working with the Drake Music Project in Scotland, the fiddler Aidan O'Rourke, his piece for Antoba Arts Centre on Mull, and Conor Mitchell's heart-hitting opera for Northern Ireland about the day when an Olympic win stopped the violence. Those three coming up later. But the other three premieres come from a BBC Singers concert at the Cheltenham Festival. The first of them is a BBC commission from composer Hugh Wood. He dedicates his piece to the memory of his good friend, the choral director John Aldiss. The words come from Ezra Pound from his Pisan Cantos. The BBC Singers, conducted by David Hill in the world premiere of Hugh Wood's From the Pisan Cantos.